No one would have believed that in the first years of the 21st century that religious affairs were being watched from the timeless worlds of the internet. No one could have dreamed they were being scrutinized as someone with a microscope studies creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. Few men even considered the possibility of religions in other cultures, and yet, across the gulf of the internet, minds immeasurably superior to yours regarded them with envious eyes, and slowly and surely drew their plans against them.
Fantastic Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds. Have you heard the remade one with Liam Neeson that was going around a couple of years ago?
Yeah.
And I considered going to see it when I was in Glasgow, but it was £60 a ticket to go and see a hologram projection of Liam Neeson dancing about stage with a guy from Take That, I believe.
Yeah, what's his name again?
Oh, I'm not going to remember.
He's off X Factor on the telly as well. To be honest, he's never off the telly, so I don't see why anybody would want to pay £60 to go and see him.
On this note of things up in the sky, of seeing things coming from the sky, this week we've got an interview with Stuart Guthrie on anthropomorphism, and he is best known for his book Faces in the Clouds.
Indeed.
Just before we start, we are the Religious Studies Project. He's David Robertson, I'm Christopher Carter, and we're in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions.
Absolutely. And I think we need to pass over to Tommy Coleman and Stuart Guthrie.
Make it so.
Dr. Stuart Guthrie is the Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at Fordham University. His work on anthropomorphism first appeared in his 1980 article, published in Current Anthropology, titled A Cognitive Theory of Religion, and later greatly expanded upon in his 1993 book, Faces in the Clouds. He's been credited by many scholars today as having kick-started the cognitive science of religion field, although Dr. Guthrie is typically very humble about this. We are very lucky to have him with us today on the Religious Study Project. Dr. Guthrie, welcome.
Thank you very much.
We will head right in here to a few questions. As I understand, you strongly consider your work on anthropomorphism to provide an explanation for religion, seeing religion quite literally as anthropomorphism. And before we get into more about anthropomorphism, I was hoping you could set the stage by telling us what it means or does not mean to explain religion.
Well, that's an excellent question, and because I was thinking of something along those lines as soon as you said that I believe that my theory explains it, which I do. So what it means to explain religion in my terms is to provide an explanation of the plausibility of what we think of as religious beliefs. Namely, central to religious beliefs, as I see it, is belief in a variety of human-like but non-human agents that we gloss in the Western tradition as God with a capital G or gods with a small g. So how is it that we can believe in those and a variety of similar spirit beings, ghosts, demons, demigods, and so on? What it doesn't explain is the huge variety of religious beliefs around the world, why any particular individual is religious or not religious. The role of ethics or morality in religion, which is one of the variables among the things that we call religion. So none of that is accounted for. It's essentially an attempt to explain the plausibility, as I said, of the human-like but non-human agents, many of whom of course, are thought of as intangible and or invisible. So that's the general purpose of this, my approach.
I just wanted to kind of set the stage for our listeners so they understood what you precisely meant by explain, that you weren't trying to say, this is it, this is the end-all, be-all of story of religion. So,
sure.
Heading right in now, what is anthropomorphism, essentially?
Well, the standard definition is the attribution of human characteristics to non-human things and events. So, defined that way, it's actually a very broad phenomenon, and it ranges everywhere from hearing a thump in the night in your house, maybe a door slamming, and thinking that it's somebody in the house when actually it was the wind. So there you have an action that was caused by a totally impersonal, non-animate phenomenon, the wind, but you attributed human action to it. So it ranges from that to visual phenomena like mistaking the headrest in a distant car for an occupant of the car, to hearing voices in the wind, to seeing design in natural phenomena like leaves or the parts of animals, which tend to give most of us, I think, a sense that we're seeing the product of design. And more broadly, that's what's known as teleology, the sense that things happen for a purpose. And when we're teleological about nature, then, in my view, we're anthropomorphizing by attributing a human characteristic of conscious goal orientation to phenomena that don't have it.
And so much of your work, I would suppose, has also been supported in more recent years by, I believe it is Deb Kalaman,
right.
Her teleological reasoning, promiscuous teleology. I believe.
Right. I think Kalman's work is very important for cognitive science of religion as a whole, and I think other people in the field feel the same way. She's frequently cited by various writers, and so she's actually providing the sort of the empirical confirmation of a view first voiced by Bacon in the mid-1600s when he attacked Aristotle's view of nature, which was teleological. And Aristotle thought that pendulums, for example, when they're set in motion, they swing back and forth and eventually come to rest in the center. And he saw the pendulum as aiming to come to the rest at the center. Or he saw pebbles on a beach sorting themselves out and aiming to congregate with pebbles of a like size. And I think that's a feeling, as I said, that we all have. But according to Bacon, it's an illusion caused by our looking at nature and trying to explain it in the same terms that we explain ourselves in. So Kalaman, to my knowledge, is the first person who's really addressed this in an empirical fashion, and I think has clearly demonstrated that it's a universal phenomenon, not only in young children, but in adults as well.
Prior to Francis Bacon, how far back have scholars been discussing the idea of anthropomorphism? How long does that extend backwards in history? For instance, maybe the ancient Greeks or Romans did.
Right. Well, the first reference that I'm familiar with, and it's one that's generally cited, is the pre-Socratic philosopher Xenophanes somewhere around 500 BC, 500 to, to 600 perhaps. And only fragments of his work remain, but he was the source of the famous quotation about Ethiopian gods having dark skin, dark eyes, and Thracian gods having having red hair and blue eyes, and adding that if lions and horses could sculpt or draw, they would represent their gods as looking like lions and horses. So that's the generally cited earliest occurrence, and scholars since then have done variations on that, particularly in the Abrahamic traditions, I think, which have been concerned to eliminate anthropomorphism as far as possible. But the theologians generally have concluded that they can't eliminate it entirely without eliminating the meaning of the notion of a god. So I think most theologians have said, well, this is not really a possible quest to totally eliminate anthropomorphism, because then we'd have a god that we couldn't pray to, for example. So they're generally content by saying, well, this is just metaphorical talk to make God understandable to us, but it shouldn't be taken literally.
So certainly a kind of anthropomorphic thought, or the idea that people may be applying this to religion or the gods, has a clear history. What brought you to kind of synthesize and bring all this prior thought together, I believe circa 1980 or so?
Yes, well, it was a combination of my dissertation fieldwork in Japan, in which I was trying to understand the ideas and actions of people in a little Japanese farming village around both the established religions in that area, which were Soto Zen Buddhism and Shinto, and a so-called new religion, which means a new religious movement of a form of Nichiren Buddhism that had come into the area a few years before and had attracted quite a membership. So I was trying to understand how they understood their lives, fortunes and misfortunes that befell them, on the one hand, and on the other, I'd been stimulated by the British anthropologist Robin Horton, an Africanist who worked in the Niger River Delta with the Kalabari people. And Horton was a follower to some extent of E.B. Tyler, and his notion of religion in a 1960 paper called A Definition and Theory of Religion, he suggested that we could define religion as the extension of human social relations beyond the purely human sphere. So that's another way of saying anthropomorphism, a term that he didn't specifically use. But at the same time, what was kind of curious about Horton was that he felt that anthropomorphism was not itself a major phenomenon, but something that he called the idiom of religious discourse, which he seems to have thought could have been carried on in some other idiom. But his notion in most of his work was that religion is actually fairly comparable to science, in the sense that both of them try to explain the world by reducing complexity to simplicity, to reducing chaos to order, and so on, and doing this by calling on concepts from ordinary life and then refining them to account for particular phenomena. So in the case of religion, to explaining things like plagues and storms and famine and so forth, and in the case of science, explaining things like atomic fission and fusion. But both of them, in his view, start with common sense experiences and then alter them as necessary to fit a different kind of world.
So religion is sort of, I guess quite literally then, is the systematic application of anthropomorphism in the world, perhaps. Maybe it's most prevalent.
That's right. I think of it as the right, relatively systematized and elaborated application of human-like features as interpretations of the world. And as such, as I was saying, I just want to stress it again, is that it's a more pervasive and diverse phenomenon than we usually think, and most of it goes on unconsciously, so it's not a deliberate kind of action. I think the usual understanding of anthropomorphism is more to the effect that we're aware of it when we do it. We do it as metaphor, sometimes to be cute, or sometimes to comfort ourselves with the thought that there's something out there like us, even if it's only by putting a smile on a representation of an apple.
Sure. Also, in your book, Faces in the Clouds, you write, and forgive me if this is kind of an abstraction, I hope it's not, but I'm deeply interested in the question here. You write, anthropomorphism is the core of religious experience. I was hoping you could perhaps expand more on this idea of anthropomorphism as the core of religious experience, if I have that correctly.
Yes, and let me begin by disclaiming novelty in that regard, because starting at least with Spinoza and Hume, and continuing with a variety of thinkers, Feuerbach, Freud, E.B. Tyler, and others, many people have made that assertion. And what I've done is to try to account for anthropomorphism itself in a new way by adding to the Spinoza and Hume approach two things, Darwinian natural selection, and as a sort of game theoretical approach to natural selection, Blaise Pascal's famous wager, in which he says that in the absence of information as to whether God exists or not, we should assume he does, because if we're right, then we stand to gain a lot, and if not, we don't lose anything. So back to your question about anthropomorphism being the core of religion, I'll invoke the name of Feuerbach first to sort of provide background to what I'm saying. And Feuerbach said that if we subtract all of the human-like qualities from our notion of God, and he's speaking for the Abrahamic tradition, then we have nothing left at all. If we subtract the notion of a human-like mind, then we don't have anyone who can will or think or have goals and ends. If we subtract the capacity for language, then we don't have someone to whom we can pray or who can communicate back to us. So my position really is somewhat different account of anthropomorphism itself from Feuerbach's, but in agreement with him and previous philosophers who urge that anthropomorphism is the core, in the sense that if we get rid of all qualities that we can identify as being specifically human-like in the context of other animals, for example, then there's nothing left to our notions of God. So in that sense, if we take some form of God, gods, ancestors, spirits, to be key to religion, and those are removed by removing anthropomorphism, then the core is gone. Let me just give one more sort of aspect of that,
please,
which is the question of what we should call things like demythologized Judaism or demythologized Christianity, which I take to mean Judaism and Christianity in terms of their historical content, the notion that there was a leader in the case of Christianity, Jesus Christ, mm-hmm. Or in the case of Judaism, that there were a variety of historical leaders. And there is, in both cases, an ethical system, which I think many many Christians and Jews who would understand themselves as demythologized, take to be important to their tradition. In my view, what we have left is, in fact, a historical accumulation of traditions, ethics, views of history minus God, mm-hmm. In which case I think we would better call it a cultural tradition, including perhaps the ethical tradition, but not religion. So that was all I wanted to add.
Thank you. Also, in your book and per our conversation right now, you make a very good case, a philosophically sound case for religion as anthropomorphism. And you alluded to earlier, Deborah Kelman certainly has some supporting studies that that confirm such. What would it take to falsify, to empirically really test kind of religion broadly construed as anthropomorphism?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it, I mean, you know, perhaps it's just so ingrained as a part of us, it's kind of like, you know, how surprised we would be if we found someone who was living but, you know, was dead, so to speak. It's kind of just a contradiction in terms.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose if we could find that a majority of people who had self-identified as believers in major religious traditions, mm-hmm. Who at the same time disclaimed a belief in a human-like but non-human being, then that would be evidence, I suppose, of one sort. I think another kind of evidence would be proof that such human-like but non-human beings exist in the world, so that attributing them human-like characteristics to them would not be misleading. That there are in fact non-human human-like beings, then we couldn't say that it was anthropomorphic to see these features in them, since part of the definition, the standard definition of anthropomorphism, just sort of involves this this contradiction. Anthropomorphism, by the standard definition, is in fact an illusion. If you take human characteristic to mean something that applies to humans and only to humans, which I take characteristic to mean in this case, it's one definition, then anthropomorphism is an illusion, and that's a standard view. And even in the Abrahamic religious traditions, it's an accepted view, because the theologians, as I was saying earlier, say that we should try to strip out as much of it as we can, because it doesn't really apply to God. So I suppose those would be two ways of falsifying the view, and I'm not sure how to operationalize that. Mm-hmm.
I suppose it will also certainly be caught up in how we define religion, which is always a factor as well. So. Some scholars have taken your theory and situated it within perhaps a more controversial framework. That might not even be the correct term, but that see the mind is extremely modular, very domain specific, and primarily offering support for Justin Barrett's and other people's hyperactive agency detection device. Do you feel that your theory supports such a cognitive pathway, or is it perhaps some kind of, perhaps an abstraction from what you're saying to kind of say, hey, we anthropomorphize things on, now we have the HAD, the hyperactive agent detection device?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't disagree in broad strokes with the notion of the hyperactive agency detection device, and that's to be expected, because Justin derived the notion of HAD from the notion of anthropomorphism. Mm-hmm. HAD differs from the notion of anthropomorphism in a couple of ways, but most importantly, in making the notion of agent broader and in fact not really closely specified. So any sort of intentional agency in terms of HAD would qualify for what Justin is talking about. And my disagreement with that is that it looks as though the prototype for intentional agency in intuitive human thought, mm-hmm. What's called, you know, the folk notion of agency, it appears that the prototype is the human person. And I base this notion in part on the work of a variety of philosophers, including the ones I've mentioned, Spinoza, Hume, Feuerbach. Mm-hmm. Also, Nietzsche is an important figure to mention, because anthropomorphism was a strong interest of his for quite a long time. And he started by trying to root it out and eliminate it from the thought of others, and finally concluded that it was impossible to root it out, because our perceptual and cognitive system, like that of all other animals, is based in our interests. And our interests in the world center more around humans than they do about anything else. So he finally gave up getting rid of anthropomorphism, and then moving into the era of cognitive science, the work of Elizabeth Spelka in developmental psychology and of Susan Carey, similarly in developmental psychology, has indicated that, as I put it, the prototype of agency for us is the human person. Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, then the sort of the generality of the term agency in HAD could be improved upon by specifying that we're really talking about people. So that's my principal complaint about that that formulation. While I'm at it, two other minor complaints.
Please.
One, the term hyperactive suggests that it's overly active, and that in turn is attributed by some writers to its having evolved in an earlier era, namely the Pleistocene, in which danger lurked behind every bush and around every boulder, and that in the modern era, it doesn't need to be so active. But I think that the present times are just as ambiguous as the world ever was. The kinds of dangers have changed. Fewer tigers around, but more people. So our need to discover human agency behind phenomena is just as strong as ever. So if excess is an implication of hyper, as I take it to be, then I think we don't need that. The other term that I'll quibble about is device, which seems to suggest modularity, and perhaps that's what you were alluding to at the beginning of your question. If modularity is an implication of the term device, then I think that's a mistake, because a module, by definition, involves a relatively narrow, restricted input and restricted output. Something like perhaps our perception of eyes and simulations of eyes. That looks modular to me, because it exists in all vertebrate species down through fishes. We all have that same sensitivity. And in us, at least, it seems to depend on the presentation of the eyes or eye spots in a relatively horizontal plane. That is to say, the two dots in the plane in which we're looking at them. And if you present two dots one above the other, they seem to mean very little. So that's perhaps that much is modularity, but our notion of the human person is diverse and complex, and ranges from form attributes such as eye spots to behavior, which of course is very complex, and includes everything that the human mind is capable of devising. And finally, something as abstract as teleology itself, that is, goal-oriented events in the world at large. So all of that, and this is to sort of sum up the point, is a very diverse set of things and events, of phenomena, not what we mean by modularity.
Cool.
So in a sense, though, those still are quibbles, because the core notion of HAD, I think, is still the same core notion that I've been trying to present, namely that a central interest of ours is detecting agency, human-like agency, in my view, and that we do it with high sensitivity and low threshold, or what is sometimes called the hair trigger response of attributing human presence.
Quibbles they may be, but they certainly seem very important ones at that, certainly for science and the advancement of it. Is there anything else that perhaps you could share with or tell our listeners about your concept, your theory of religion as anthropomorphism, that perhaps you could share with us before we end?
Well, a couple of things. I'll allude to Nietzsche again and say that contemporary cognitive science appears to bear him out by discovering that this attribution of human characteristics of various sorts is something that we can't really get rid of, that it appears mostly unconscious, that it's spontaneous and automatic, so that in looking at something like the Heider-Simmel animation in which a couple of dark triangles and a dark circle follow each other around on a flat screen and around a rectangular line drawing that most viewers interpret as being a building. Although the triangle and triangles and circle are only geometric figures on a flat surface, virtually every observer who's asked to watch it and interpret the animation interprets it in terms of social interactions. So it appears that it's a that the response of thinking that there's a human-like agent present is independent of having anything that looks like a human or even anything that appears to be three-dimensional action. It's something that you could call merely symbolic action in that the viewers seem to be interpreting the geometric figures as symbols of humans. And their interpretation of it as social action is not at all impeded by the symbolic nature of the representation. And that sort of work is being continued by Tremblay at Yale with more complex and in some ways more sophisticated representations, which he calls sheep and wolf, in which he has a series of triangles apparently pursuing or at least orienting themselves toward another geometric figure on the screen. And he finds very, very complex interpretations of the actions of these figures. So there's been a good bit of work on agent perception, as you doubtless know, and all of it seems to be finding that agency perception is of this sort of unpremeditated, automatic, spontaneous sort. That so that even knowing that what we're looking at is not a human, we can't help but interpreting. But interpret it as human-like. So that's, I think, what I want to emphasize is this sort of uncontrollable automatic quality to the response. And I think that's the appropriate topic for further work, for locating the brain areas that are involved, and sort of testing the limits of that response and seeing what the disconfirming cognitive activities are. At what point do we want to say, well, this is giving us a human-like impression or an agent-like impression, but I conclude that it's not.
Thank you very much for being on the program today, Dr. Guthrie.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
If our listeners out there, if you're interested in hearing more on anthropomorphism, then by all means, please go to the Religious Studies Project website, click on the Amazon link so the Religious Studies Project can make a few pennies in the process of purchasing Dr. Guthrie's book.
I'm really glad that we've been able to have Stuart Guthrie on the podcast. Something that's very interesting about Guthrie's work is that it harks back to the 19th century theorists, your Tylers and your Frasers and these large reductionist kind of theories. And these are almost dirty words in the discipline, Chris. But
yeah. Need not be if... one is explicit and it is done with a level of theoretical sophistication and attention to detail.
You know, I was thinking about this yesterday. It seems to me that the whole sort of... That a theory be rejected because it is reductionist, that a theory be necessarily rejected because it's reductionist. You often hear that as a critique, don't you? But, you know, Marx's theory is very interesting, but it's reductionist. Well, why shouldn't things be reductionist? And I wonder if maybe that aversion that the field has towards reductionist theories is maybe a problem of our relationship with our field of study.
I saw a very interesting article yesterday, which I posted to the RSP page. It wasn't an article, it was on Travis Cooper's blog. Travis Cooper has written for the RS Project, and it was just a quote from a book. It was about how the social sciences had this tendency to parcel off, let's say, reality, in quotation marks, parcel off into sort of distinct areas of study, and you get people who specialize, and then you end up with this sort of self-perpetuating thing where theories are either called too reductionistic, or people poke loads of holes in them and show how it's not, you know, it's too broad, and they're sort of self-perpetuating, and there's no way that social sciences can ever in that sense. So maybe it's something to do with social sciences in general.
Yes, but I think there's also definitely a desire to avoid reductionist theories, as they're seen as explaining away this phenomena that we apparently are often acting more as caretakers than critics of. We wouldn't want to explain it away, because then where would we get our funding? Where, you know, how could the discipline continue if we get rid of the thing we're talking about?
Absolutely.
So, on that controversial comment...
We're going to have a few more weeks of controversy, I think.
I think so too, yeah, well, I think you saw where I was going with that, why don't you tell us about next week's interview?
Well, next week is our second in our Origins series.
I'm doing scare quotes.
Yeah. Origins. Our quote Origins unquote series.
Could we call it reductionism? we call it reductionism month.
Yeah,
here at the RSP.
We could do. And it's with Robert McCauley. It's another interview that Tommy Coleman recorded. And it's got the provocative title, Why Religion is Natural and Science is Not. So there's a clear statement coming from the title of that interview. And we're looking forward to hearing what you think about it.
Let's leave that to hang controversially there. We can unpack that a little bit more next week.
We can indeed.
But for now, have we any news?
Well, this coming Saturday, there's going to be a conference happening in Edinburgh. It's sort of just a small postgrad conference organised by our pal Chris Duncan. It's sort of called the Edinburgh Area Religion Scholars Conference. And it's just a conference, an eclectic mix of postgrad papers, but we're gonna use that as a sort of sounding board for some RSP ideas for future conferences and things. So expect a roundtable from that. Expect some presentation recordings, and we're maybe gonna try some videoing as well, which we've never yet done.
We're definitely recording a roundtable. The closing roundtable of the conference we'll be recording. Do we have a hashtag yet?
We will do. Watch Facebook and Twitter.
Indeed. Yeah, we'll make sure that gets out. But that's going to be interesting. So if you're in the Edinburgh area and you fancy hearing some provocative, controversial, interesting, theoretically sound papers on the study of religion in the RSP style, in a relaxed and friendly atmosphere.
Of course, beer and pizza.
With beer and pizza, then get down to a new college on Saturday.
Send us an email. We'll let you know.
There's other RSP news, but we'll wait till next week to share that. For now, thanks for listening.